Is she a chalice chipper?
No. Oh. No.
Not even close?
No.
Maybe a little bit.
Huh. You know this. You have to spend longer than a year and a half in sim to even really be a seminarian. So there was no chalice even put in. So that's your words, Father. Those are your words. You always told guys you got to go 2 years or you're not a real seminarian. I didn't go 2 years.
I somebody's making a send you a bill.
No. I use it. I'm a good steward. I'm a good steward. Okay.
That would work, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, well, since Father messed up a prayer, well, let's try that again, okay? So, here we go. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Come, Holy Spirit, I pray that you come upon us tonight and enlighten us with your wisdom. And bless me as I try to speak to the truth, goodness, and beauty of you, the beatific vision. And may we come to know you more truly in this community, so that one day we may be in the ultimate community of heaven together. And we pray glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Saint Benedict, pray for us. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen.
Are you on?
Am I on? Oh, yeah, I record. Yep. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is kind of put disclaimer out there, okay? This is not a public versus private school conversation. It's nothing like that. It's more centered on just kind of the purpose of a good education, which can be pretty universal, typically found in a school setting, but also can apply to a lot of different aspects in life. I believe there's a couple of things that are just part of human nature. One of them is to be like tillers of the soil. I think everyone can. I mean, you know, that's part of creation, right? And we know one of the curses just the way that we were to reclaim our sanity was, you know, we have to till the soil, but there's going to be weeds in it, right? And I think that everyone has a place to play in some sort of farming, right? Some are much better than others. Some might just do a backyard garden and yield two tomatoes like I did last year. But then some people might do hundreds of crops. But I think that's something that's innate that you can eventually figure out and get better at. And so, too, I think it's true with education. I think everyone can be a teacher. We see that in so many ways. Are there better ways to teach? Absolutely. Okay. But I think that it's a part of everyone's heart. So no matter what you're doing in your life, there's some way that you teach. And so my hope is that this talk helps you think about the way that you educate others, right? And then in our call to educate and bring people into the kingdom of heaven, all right? So I'm going to more so speak about education in a school setting. I don't want to discredit homeschooling. I definitely think it is a viable option. I definitely think some families are called into it. And I would suggest anyone who would be doing homeschooling, my personal opinion is, don't try to play school. Don't try to make it look like a school. I think the beauty of homeschooling is you get to create, there's a freedom of structure and possible exposures to your kids. So if you ever want to pick my brain on that, I'm happy to talk about it. But it's not necessarily even about homeschooling, although I think some things, like I said, can universally apply. Okay. Now, the other thing I would say is I think we're in a state of education. I read this thing called The Loop. All right. So The Loop is by Catholic Vote. It comes out daily. I definitely know this. I know that there is currently in the Catholic world, in the Christian world, there is a bashing of public schools, a bashing of it. I read it, things that I really agree, a lot of the realms that I think and I agree with, and some of the things you read, I'm going to be the first to say that that's not happening here in this town, okay? A lot of those things, they're just not happening here, right? There are bad Catholic schools. I have heard from friends that went to Catholic schools. I think there are some Catholic schools that move people away from heaven, right? I think there are some public schools that draw kids towards heaven, okay? And I think it can be vice versa. So I would say that, you know, the one thing I would also say is hopefully, at one of my hopes is at the end of this night, you can know when you read the news and stuff that with me at the helm of Colwich Elementary, those things you read are not true here. Okay? That's one hope I do have. All right? So let's begin. Now, as a teacher, okay, I'm going to not go full-blown teacher on you, but I will be having you do some discussion tonight. And I got an opening question that you're going to have with those around you. Okay? And it's this. Who was your favorite teacher and what made them great, in your opinion? Go ahead and discuss.
And she was just there for me. No matter what I needed, I knew that I could ask her and she'd take care of me. I didn't have to sit in a corner and cry about it. So that was, I'll always remember, because she took care of me. You didn't have one?
Sister Cecilia Marie, put me in her. She evaluated me to be the last of the class.
Cecilia Marie, who?
Sister Cecilia Marie. She was beautiful.
Was she at CSJ or ASC?
Okay, we're going to kind of bring, hopefully you at least thought of someone if you didn't get a share, but I'm sure maybe even some of you, if I put this out there and I said, let's open it up to coaches or someone who like you've worked with and you feel like was a teacher of your trade, maybe it's in a place you work, something like that. Most of the time, we would say a couple things. One, they believed in me, didn't just care about me, but they believed in me, and they held high expectations for me. And usually a third one you might find is, I know that they cared about what they taught, that they believed that what they taught would enrich my life. Okay? Typically the three things you find. All right? So, hold on to that because we're going to circle back to some of those traits. A little about me. My grandpa, he come from a farming family up in Topeka. The Great Depression kind of came through and ruined their farm with the Dust Bowl and stuff. And so he went in. His dad then served in World War I. Okay? My grandpa served in the Army in World War II. But he was a pilot, and he was one of the first people of the Air Force, okay? So we still have both uniforms that he has. When he got out, seeing that, he wanted a job with stability. So he went into education. He became a teacher and a principal and then a superintendent down in Oswego, Kansas. My grandpa had 10 kids. One passed away within the first year, the other nine. So my dad's the runt of the litter, and a lot of them became educators. A lot of them graduated from Pitt State University. We had one who graduated from Emporia State, but a lot of them went to Pitt State. I think one time I counted it up, I got like 17 aunts and uncles that graduated to be a teacher. And there's three of them that became superintendents, a couple that became principals, ADs, things like that. So, and then a lot of cousins that went into it. It's kind of a family trait. My brother is a principal and superintendent down in Howard, Kansas at West Elk. My sister and brother-in-law were educators, and now my brother-in-law works at Via Christi. He was a seminarian. He did it for 4 years, and then he left. So anyway, you can ask him the chalice chipping question, but anyway, so now he kind of works there, and he uses his master's in theology and his teaching degree to like kind of do some of the ministry part of Via Christi Hospitals, educating the workers there on kind of their history and stuff. So it's kind of a family trait. We talk about it a lot, and we like education. I grew up in Baxter Springs, Kansas. We had 272 kids in the high school when I was there, three Catholics in the high school. And we were the only three Catholics in the whole district, K-12. So that's what I grew up in. One of my best friends from Riverton, my dad started his career there, very Quaker-heavy town. There was only one Catholic in the whole school, and it was very similar. I grew up in the Bible Belt. All right. There were more Protestant churches than there were McDonald's in Wichita. Okay, there were a lot. All right, and I grew up in an area where, like, if you had a disagreement, we go start our own church. Okay, and so that's kind of what I grew up in. A lot of people, you know, you hear some of those stereotypes. They're true, of people thinking Catholics aren't Christians. Grew up with that. I even had sometimes teachers would pull me out of class to try to evangelize to me and talk to me about my faith and say how it's wrong and things like that. It's kind of an interesting experience, but it helped make me stronger. I got involved in FCA, and I always liked my faith. Our family, we never missed. There's probably 50 families in our parish, I would say. And so it was, we only had Mass on Saturday afternoons, and it was a good place to be. I do think, so then my brother goes off to Pitt State, and he finds the Newman Center, and he really falls in love with his faith. So what happens is my brother was a great athlete. He was really good at football. He went to Pitt State to play, and he was an all-conference tight end for there. One night he comes home. He's supposed to check in on me because my parents are gone. He wakes me up at 2 a.m., and he says, "Hey, big dog, you want some bacon and eggs?" I said, "What time is it?" He said, 2 a.m. I said, "All right." So we get up, and we're making bacon and eggs. And a little side funny story, he shows me you make bacon, and then in that grease you make the eggs. I did that the first week I was married to my beautiful bride, who comes from a very health-conscious family. And she said, "Man, these are great." I said, "Yeah, I cooked the eggs in the bacon grease." And I thought she was going to throw it all up, but she didn't. So, he raised a good one, Carla. I know that didn't come from you, Joe. So, anyway, so we're eating this, and he drops this bomb on me. So, he's an all-conference tight end, and he says, "Hey, I'm thinking about the seminary." So, okay. And he's telling me about it, and he said, "I'm prepared to go if God calls me." So he said, "Let's make a pact. If we feel God calling us, we leave. In that moment, we just go. We do it." I said, "Well, let's do it." So we shook on it. And that stuck with me. I went to Benedictine College, where I did football and track up there. And there, my life changed. So it's a liberal arts school. And there you have to take some philosophy and stuff like that. Now, I was pretty pumped to go to a Catholic school. Coming from a place which was like the Catholic desert, it was awesome. There was a group at St. Mary's Colgan in Pittsburgh called Knights of Our Lady. Very similar to a group in Wichita's Bishop Carroll called Knights of the Holy Queen. There was a guy who went who played football at Pitt State and was an All-American player. He got it started down there. My sophomore year, I was on the golf team at Baxter because they had five guys, and Glenn Crott said, we need a sixth guy, and I said, I don't know if you could qualify what I do on a course is actually golfing. He says, doesn't matter. We'll take you. Circle 10 will be your best friend, and it was. And so, I golfed with a guy from Colgan who invited me up to Knights of Our Lady, so I went. My senior year, I didn't go to my senior year. My parents were like, we don't want you driving up to Pittsburgh until you're a little older. So I did, and there was the first time I was around like a bunch of Catholic men. Father Chad Arnold was the chaplain there, and all it was so simple. We prayed a rosary, and then we went out to B-Dubs to eat some buffalo wings. Super simple, but meant the world to me. Okay? And so I went to Benedictine. I wanted something very similar on the football team, but then I get really involved in my faith. And that was a great story in my life that doesn't have to do with this talk. So I'm going to fast forward to, I go back to serve a funeral mass in Galena, Kansas, and I'm sitting up there and not expecting it, and just, boom, I'm telling you, I can remember where I was at. It was April 13th, and I was like, felt God calling me to seminary. And it wasn't the priesthood. I look back on that and I think about that, and it felt very... Now, so I remember we get done with... we're at the cemetery site. We get back in the car and I tell my parents, I'm going to seminary next year. I just told them right there, and they kind of looked at me very shocked. And I said, nope, I'm going to do it. So I did it. I had one more semester of Benedictine because you have to go through this process. Somehow I passed the psych eval test and I made it in. So I go in January and I meet these guys who, like, my time at Conception. So this is where my talk's really going to begin. Because my time at Conception Seminary, we were in the middle of nowhere, Missouri. There was 100 guys. And we were studying philosophy. The educational the homework we had was pretty minimal. And we had nothing else to do. We weren't allowed to leave the campus. And it was awesome. Like, when you have no women to pursue or sports to play, you got a lot of time on your hands. And I spent a lot of time talking with those guys. And it was just, it was almost like if you've ever seen Dead Poets Society, like this idea of being off. It was like that kind of came to life for me. Now, not everyone who went there would say that. I've known many guys who they thought that might as well have been prison, and that will be their purgatory, is going back to Conception Seminary. But for me, I loved it, and I have a lot of memories, like staring on this bluff and just seeing the stars at night, talking about things we were talking about in philosophy class. And it was unreal. But then I also have memories of there was a big pile of dirt and Father Isaac Coulter instituting a King of the Hill battle on there, and we're chucking each other off. And then there was a couple guys from Bishop Carroll who wrestled, and we got in a wrestling match, and these monks come out and they just start like cheering us on to see who's going to pin the other one. And so you had a little bit of both, right? It was awesome. But I remember, so I was in Totus Tuus. I came off like, I remember coming off a semester where I felt so sure. And I'm like, man, this is what I think is going to, where my life's going. And then I'm out at Camp Totus Tuus, and I'm feeling this call to leave seminary. I'm like, I don't know. I'm really loving seminary right now. And I remember being in adoration, and I remember God saying, He said, you went when I asked you to go. Why won't you leave? I said, okay, fair enough. So I made up my decision then. And so I talked to Father Mike Simone, and he was like, yep, that sounds about right. Go do that. And I knew I wanted to be in education. I'd done Totus Tuus. I loved working with the youth. And so I went to Pitt State because it was much cheaper than Benedictine, and I was no longer physically fit to have an athletic scholarship. So that's where I went. But one thing had changed was this journey in my way that I viewed education. So we're going to talk a little bit about liberal arts education, and maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't, but this is your next question with your group. What is a liberal arts education. If you don't know how to define it, what would you think would be some classes that would make it different than maybe a public university or a public school, okay? Or not necessarily public school, but just from your more what you might think of education, right? So how would you define it? And if you can't think of a definition, what would be some classes you think would be a part of it? Go ahead. You guys ever heard of it before? Liberal arts education?
Yes, but that's why we're like going, so think of, because I didn't go that path. So
yeah.
Like, what would that be? What would the liberal arts version of that be? Lord Almighty, what did you say? Art? Painting.
Okay.
Exactly. And I'm like, arts? Yeah, arts. That's funny because all I can think about is what I, you know.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So, one of the things that I ran into when I was in seminary was, and this was Father Isaac Coulter who introduced me to this writer. His name's John Senior. He wrote, he taught at KU. He taught in the humanities program up there. It's a pretty fascinating story that I won't dive too much into right now, but John Senior wrote two works that are really good. One is called Death of Christian Culture, and one's called Restoration of Christian Culture. And by Christian culture, he means kind of more Western civilization. Now, he was teaching these students, and the humanities is another way you kind of hear the liberal arts. And he was teaching these students through a liberal arts education at KU. The long short of the story is that program ends up getting shut down because so many people converted to Catholicism because of it. They did an investigation and found they were doing nothing fishy. Just through what they were exposing the kids to, through truth, goodness, and beauty, it was bringing them to their Catholic faith. It's an amazing story. It was very influential to me as I went into education. But here's how he defines liberal education, because it's necessary that you define your terms. By liberal education, I mean an ordering and an integration of knowledge for the benefit of the free person. That's what liberal means, a freedom, okay? As contested with technical or professional schooling or what we call career education. Okay, so get rid of any thought that you think of liberal, right? Maybe you have that dog bowl that says liberal tears in here, right? That's not the liberal we're talking about. We're talking about a freedom. Okay, so the liberal education is to benefit the free person. Education now is for career education. Here's a little backstory of the education y'all probably received, because I did too. America in its early years was very unruly. Okay, it had some people who kind of came to govern it, but most of the people who came were not first-class citizens. First-class citizens really didn't leave their European areas. Okay. It came from people trying to create an opportunity, so they were unruly. But we're in a democratic republic, and so we needed to have educated people so we could have educated voters and people who are upholding the government of the people by the people. It makes sense, right? And so a gentleman named Horace Mann, he felt education should be public and brought to everyone. Now, he is the guy who made education completely different. And he ended up going on a tour of some European countries. He went, Prussia specifically was one that highly influenced him. He saw what they were doing. They had students assorted into grades, and classes based off of their age. And so you'd be a grade based off your age, and then classes specifically. So we're going to teach math, we're going to teach science, we're going to teach rhetoric, we're going to teach, okay, so such and such. They had this idea in the industrial world to industrialize school, make it a factory-based education. Okay, it wasn't a bad idea per se. The Industrial Revolution comes about, you're going from an agrarian world to an industrialized world. It's a different set of knowledge. And there was this thought that things that could apply in this realm could also apply there and vice versa. And so that's what they were wanting to do. But going back to John Sr., he says, true education is meant to develop the individual human being, the person, rather than to serve the state. Its purpose was not to indoctrinate a young person in civics, but rather to teach what is to be a true human being, living within a moral order. The person has primacy in liberal education. What Horace Mann got wrong, and I do think was done with the best intentions, was he put the industrial world, serving it, building it up, serving the state, being efficient, he put that as the end goal of education, not the development of the human being. I think that's when things get off-centered, okay? Because I want you to think of that favorite teacher you mentioned earlier. Here's my next question to talk about. Did they teach you what it meant to be a true human being? Or did they teach you content? When you thought of them, did you have an example where you're like, the best thing they did was teach me how to multiply? Or did you say, I knew they cared? You know, they did this for me. One time they stayed late so I could work on an assignment that I was really struggling with. Or I had this problem. I was going through this in my life. Dad was gone. Mom was stressed. I was carrying this baggage. And they just let me talk. They just listened. Did they teach you what it meant to be a better human being? Or did they just teach you their content area? Talk with those at your table. What did they do? What would you say they did? And what's an example of them developing you as a human outside of their content?
Teacher Mr. Schellnhammer. He would stay late. I would go into class all frazzled that I made it way back when right now. Anyways, I'll go in all frazzled. He would just be like, okay, hey, let's just talk about this. This is simple. And it was just like, oh yeah. Just very good reminder. Kind of get me out of my head. And so he's very good. Yeah. I remember you coming home saying, I'd be talking about Schellnhammer. He'd just kind of talk you off the ledge.
Yeah.
Walk you back.
The science experiment we have with Mr. Schellhammer.
Yes.
But tell Mr. Burke.
We had to come up with something about what's a cause and effect thing, and Dad goes, why don't you do it over a fart? I was like, I'm not doing that. He goes, no.
So it wasn't, though. It was more to it than that. It was like,
all about the protein and how it synthesizing your body and gut and everything. And I still remember it because it was so odd.
And you went and talked to him, and he's like, you're weird.
Because we had to present in front of the class. No, I had to say it in front of the whole class. I was like, so I did it over. He was just like, okay, all right. I was a freshman. He was like, that's not going to be good.
That's how you make a name for yourself, though.
I did. I didn't forget about me. I swam all 4 years, and he was my coach, too, so.
Nice. That's awesome.
Oh my God, where'd your daughter go?
Okay. Let's wrap those conversations up. So here's what Senior says, and I agree with. He says, there's two questions education should answer. One, why is there something rather than nothing? And number two, what is my purpose? Why is there something rather than nothing? And what is my purpose? As I reflect back and I think about what was it that conception did, Benedictine started by me having to take some philosophy classes, but through the pure environment of conception that did well, that was on a forefront. What was my purpose? Well, I was trying to discern that every day. Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, we talked about that a lot. And that is, every human wants to know the answer to those. I used to tell my students as extra credit, I was a science teacher, I said, extra credit if anyone wants it. Spend 1 hour staring up at the stars at night. And then tell me what you thought about. Never had a student take me up on it. I said, but I did have a student say, why do you say that? I said, because boredom, humans don't like to be bored. But it's good because then you will try to satisfy that through your curiosity and wonder. And by feeling that boredom, you will push through, your intellect will push through, and it will start to really ask certain questions and it will seek answers. But I think part of the problem is we have so many distractions in our life that we don't have to wrestle with those questions. We can escape those questions, those existential questions, and that's the problem. But a good education will pose those. So here's three problems. I'm going to give you three problems that Senior says, and we're going to move on to solutions, okay? Because it's not just good. That's the thing. Don't just read Death of Christian Culture. You need to read Restoration, because that's where you start to get hope back. He says, one problem with modern education. We are not guiding students to happiness. What's their purpose or vocation? You know, this world teaches pleasure is equal to happiness. But if it did, all men would be happy and good only when all men are rich. Yeah, we know that's not the case. We often make capital, money, we make financial moves, our end pursuit. How do I know this? We do it in schools. We promote it all the time. We don't discuss, hey, what career do you want to get into that's going to build up this community? We say, hey, do you know how much more money you'll make getting a high school degree, getting a college degree? Do you know you have? Hey, I've heard this from so many educators. They tell their kids, don't go into education, you'll never make money. They don't pay enough. They sure as heck don't talk about all the lives you're going to change. I have heard family members say that. Educators are some of the worst advocates for our own field. We make capital an end. And it's not. A guy I really respect, he's actually in here, Gerard Eck. Okay, he works for Legacy Bank. I'll never forget, I was with Gerard and he said one time, I love working at Legacy Bank. I get so excited at how much good, like when I can get someone a loan to pursue their dreams. It was never, when he said it, I knew for a fact it wasn't about, even though he works with capital, he works with finances, people come to him for these things. He truly believes that in his job at Legacy Bank, he can make this community better. Now, maybe will he become rich doing that? He might, but that's a byproduct, not the goal of his career. We need our kids to think like that. Maybe you become rich. Maybe you are just blue collar and you're like Lou Holtz, who said, I always know I had enough to eat because anytime I asked for seconds, my dad said, no, you had enough. You know, that's okay. You never hear Lou Holtz complain about his family kind of growing up in poverty. In fact, actually, my favorite stories to hear about anyone who kind of grew, they always, like, a lot of their favorite stories were kind of like just getting by with what we had. It's a beautiful testimony. You know, we make capital an end and we wonder why beauty is no longer a part of our labor or our construction in this world. Why we have ugly buildings, why we have ugly, like, we can have some very just craftsmanship. It's not, or I should say, it's not ugly, it is just like a saltine cracker. Like, you can eat it, like, okay. But you look at some of these old homes and you can just see this beauty. Like, I think about some of these homes I see that were built in the 20s and how proud the original owners were probably about this little piece on their front porch that framed the windows. Like, beauty was an end within itself, and it was okay to spend extra even if it did nothing in your life. The second problem. We view knowledge as a novelty. This is proven through testing. Assessment is necessary in education. Assessment is our dipstick. It is like going to your car, pulling out the dipstick and seeing, how's my oil level? That's assessment. Testing, this is the worst type of testing a teacher can do. They don't do any form of assessment. They let you go. They teach you. They give you a final test. You get a grade. And they say, moving on. What does that do for you? If you failed it, there's no like, all right, we got to go back and do this. Or they don't even know if you're not getting there. Assessment lets you know. Testing is like having a summative assessment is an intricate part. But the best educators know that quizzes and tests are feedback to me. They're not a gotcha game for the kids. Or if you would have studied harder. No, it's a feedback to the educator to know, am I reaching this kid, yes or no? It's their dipstick check on that kid. Okay, so it's not just about consuming just a pump and dump of information. Oh, do you remember any of the questions on that test you got 100% on 2 months ago? Absolutely not. I just memorized my answers. I put them on there. Got an A. Can't remember it. And I know people like that. I'm sure some of you know stuff like that. And there's some times I've done that, like when I passed my driver's test, okay? But luckily I haven't gotten in a wreck, except with multiple deer, okay? But you know, Senior says this, the long tradition of Western civilization says education is the acquisition of not only skill, but a discipline. Which in turn means not the exercise of our heart, soul, and strength and mind in the service of our appetites, so what we want, but the subjection of our appetites to the rules of intelligence. Perhaps the purpose of science, business, and knowledge itself is not the conquest of nature after all, but rather that through understanding nature, we might come to the conquest of ourselves. We can better understand the human being through science, math, through natural observations, okay? Our science, vocational technology, engineering, math, they must be promoted through this lens, that not this world is to be conquered by man, but that by understanding this world, we can better understand ourselves and what it means to live in temperance within this world. I better understand myself because I've taken anatomy and physiology class. I better understand this house I'm building because of an engineering class I'm taking. Right? We can better understand this world. That's what it should do. The third problem with modern education is it fails to affirm objective truth. You know, the basic premise for any argument is that either something is or is not. You can't have an argument unless you can agree that something is either is or it is not. You can't say at the top of this table, oh, is it black? Oh, I don't know. It's up to you to decide. No, it either is or we can't have an argument if we can't agree that there's an objective truth, a first premise, okay? So that's what's led to relativism, along with vices. But Senior says, the motive force of modernism is as the name suggests, this perpetual, and you listen to this because this is so true, this urge for the new, not the real, not the true, not the ideal, not even evil, not the power or the glory or the lust, but all these things for the sake of new, cut off from reality by 400 years of criticism and doubt. The modernist insists on a new, very quickly exhausting the contents of his memory and proceeds to invent an artificial one. What's the big thing? Artificial intelligence, right? What we look to keep invent, we don't stop to think, is this good? We don't. So here's a question. Let's see, a little pop quiz. How do the Amish decide if they're going to bring in a new piece of technology? See if anyone at your table knows. Because they do. How do they make that decision? What did he say?
Was it invented past a certain date?
Nope. That's a good guess. Okay, let's see. Raise your hands. How many of you guys was it invented past a certain date? How many think that that's it? They said this is the date, and anything invented after this is not good. No? Okay. All right.
They Google it.
It's a good one. Yeah. No, they actually, and this is, I wanted to get the exact language. I had heard this, and I'm like, I sure hope this is true. So I did Google this, and I found it from an official Amish site. They said, when new technology comes along, its effect on the church and community is examined. The technology should not be an intrusion into the home, but rather serve the social purpose and goals of the group. With that in mind, the Amish often repurpose the technology, in a sense, to align with their community beliefs. They ask one question. Will this piece of technology build or destroy our community? That's it. So, like, why do they not have telephones in their homes? Because they say, if I put a telephone in my home, I no longer need to walk to their house. And if I stop walking to their house, I'll stop having porch talk with them. And if I stop having porch talk with them, then I'm not going to know them. Okay? Why do I not want a car? Because if I have a car, I'm going to have a reason to leave. It's going to be easy to leave. And if I leave, I won't stay in this community and spend my nights here. They look through everything with the lenses. Does it build up community? Yes or no? A lot of them don't have tractors. But there are some Amish communities that do, because their numbers are small enough. They say, hey, this will not destroy our community. And they have a group of elders who make that decision. That's what, and I know Paul can attest, I said this at the start of the year, that's how we'll look at technology. If you want to give a quiz or a test through an online format, because that's okay, because guess what? Now you know, technology can assess and find these gaps in learning. That is that feedback to self. And it saves you maybe 4 hours on a Saturday that could be spent with your spouse, your kids, your grandkids. But instead of you being up at the school grading these papers and trying to find this data collection yourself, what's the most important community? It's the family, right? So I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. You know, screens, we have to be very careful of the technology. And I mean that not just in screens, but ultimately, we have to curb our ideas and show students how to control their appetites, or else they will seek the new without seeking truth. That's the problem with technology. They will continue to seek the new because that's how people profit, right? They keep getting that brain to light up to these new things, okay? Mm-hmm. We as educators hopefully can teach them the virtue of temperance with new technology. That's the goal, right? This ties into the idea that education should be to be control our appetites and not fulfill them. So how do we fix this? Well, Benedictine starts me down this path. I love the humanities. I realize Western civilization is a part of my inheritance. It's part of your inheritance. It's been going on for a long time. It was something robbed of me in my education. And my dad was technically in charge of my education. And I've told him that before. And he's come to agree with it. I learned there are conversations that have been going on for 2,000 years. It started with Homer and Plato and Aristotle and Virgil and Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and Dante, Shakespeare, Bacon, Descartes, Milton, Pascal, Locke, Kant, Dickens, Darwin, Marx, Tolstoy, Freud, and many more great minds in between, and I'm sure will come, are a part of this great conversation that is living. It is living. That's the thing about when you hear these ideas of classical education, the humanities, this good philosophy is, good philosophy started with Homer. They didn't maybe agree, they might have disagreed, but they are talking about, hey, I disagree with Plato's idea of this. They are engaging in the conversation. New philosophers, people like Peter Singer, who wants to come out and say, hey, and this is real, hey, maybe if you have a burning building and you have such a severely handicapped human being over here that they can't add anything to this world, and an orangutan here, and you have to choose which one you're going to save, choose the orangutan because it has more personhood. Right? Peter Singer is not a part of this conversation. He just comes at ground zero and says, here's where we're going from, here's what I think. Modern philosophers, some even modern scientists, they will do that. They just jump in and say, hey, we're going to forget everything that's ever been talked about in the past because it's old. And we're going to start creating our new stuff. But there is this intellectual inheritance that's ours by our birthright, part of Western civilization. It's part of our Christian culture. So this led me into the classical approach of learning. There's more of a story how I get there, but I hear about classical education. I hear about these things. So when you hear classical education, the classical approach of learning, what do you think is a part of it? What is classical education? Let's see if anyone at your table knows or has heard of it. What do you say? We have a school in town that is a classical school. Let's see if some of you might know what they're all about.
Emphasis on the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Teaching the whole person.
Understand the problem. Be more problem solving. No matter how hard it is, we need to be able to solve the problem. Not just reaching out. Memorization.
Okay, maybe start wrapping that up. So, there was a guy named Boethius. He lived around the late 400s, 500s. He came up with something called the trivium and the quadrivium. There's the seven liberal arts, as he coined them. The trivium is grammar, logic, rhetoric. The quadrivium is arithmetic, astronomy, geometry, and music. Classical education, as some of you may know, is centered on the trivium, those first three. That's going to be like a K-12. Back in the day, it was really kind of like starting around the age of 8 until about 16. That's kind of how that'd be about the age range they would educate. Susan Wise Bauer, she wrote a book called The Well-Trained Mind. If you do homeschool, or you want to supplement your child's education with some of classical education principles, she wrote this book called The Well-Trained Mind. It has actual resources, kind of explains things. It's amazing, okay? But she says, a classical education then has two important aspects. It's language-focused, and it follows a specific three-part pattern. One, the mind must be first supplied with facts and images, then given, two, logical tools for organization of facts, and three, finally equipped to express conclusions. That's classical education. It's not logic, it's not theology, it's not can you sew a button on a shirt, or do you know how to take care of chickens? That's not classical education. Classical education is based off the grammar, logic, and rhetoric stage. Okay? So, what has been taught since Boethius' time has been confirmed by modern science. This is pretty interesting. So, so the grammar stage, they would say, kids don't really know logic. And if you talk to like a 5 to 7 year old, they don't understand logic very well. They can understand a little bit. But what do they really love to do? They love to read books 1,000 times, the same one. They love to show you that they can sing their ABCs. They love repetition, repetition, repetition. So, in classical education, you teach them rules. You don't need to teach them the why behind the rules, but you teach them the rules. And Susan Wise Barrett says these are like pegs being hung up. Teach them all these rules, and they love it, and you just feed it. It's also called the parrot stage. I say, then they say. I say, then they say. Then, in the logic stage, this is the argumentative stage. It's when kids like to argue, and they like to test things. It's like 4th through 6th grade. So you let them see logic. Now, here's the glory of it. You're not doing logic without any facts. They can actually have somewhat of an argument with you because they have all these facts to draw from. So now you're putting these rings on these pegs. The rhetoric stage is now they have the trivial facts. They have this grammar stage. They know these rules. Then they have the logic stage where they see that these rules are true. And then the rhetoric stage is they get to add to the conversation. They can actually add to it. If something was put out there, they could speak their own opinion on it. And that's where you tie these pegs together. They could have two novels and tell you how they're similar or different. Okay? Now, are there ways to better do that? Absolutely. Do I think that Latin is a phenomenal way to teach logic through grammar? Absolutely. So there are maybe better avenues to do these things. I'm not denying that. But a classical education specifically is grammar and logic and then rhetoric. And there is a bill in the state of Kansas that's being pushed on the science of reading, which every single school in Kansas will have to teach reading this way going forward. Every single teacher will have to get training on this for recertification in the elementary level. And they think that they've stumbled across something new, but it is pretty much the classical approach to teaching kids how to read. It's the same way Mortimer Adler wrote about it, who was one of the great minds who came up with the thought of the great... He wrote a book called How to Read a Book. And it was written in the 40s. And it's the same way that you would do a classical style approach to teaching children how to read and write. And so what one side is coming in finding through science, the natural human being best learns this way, has always been taught. Maybe they didn't understand the neurological side to why this is good, like PJ's figurines. But it's being done, and that's a beautiful sign, because what? Truth confers goodness. It affirms that, right? It affirms the goodness that has long been known. So that's amazing too, okay? So the other piece is understanding that we want to seek out education because it's supposed to make possible our discovery what is truly good, to form our mind to desire the good, and to train us in the virtues necessary to obtain it. To be born in wonder. So here's my question. What stirs your heart to wonder? When you feel this sense of wonder, what are some things that stir you to wonder? Like for me, I drove the bus route with just a van to pick up some kids this last quarter. And I'll tell you what, seeing the green grass, like right there on the farms as the sun's coming up, like every time, that gets me every single time. So what are some things that stir your heart to wonder, that make you kind of stand back and just go, whoa, that's amazing? Okay, go ahead and share something with your tape. Wrap it.
back for a second.
Okay. Give me 10 more minutes. I got it. I'm moving on. Watch. I got to get to this last part. It's all right. I got it. 10 minutes. I'm done. 10 minutes. Okay. So, one of the things we have to understand is, why is it important? Because wonder is what makes us, this is what Aristotle says, it's seeing things as they are and wondering what causes them to be. That was that first question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Okay? And wonder is this encounter with the real, with true. Truth, finding truth leads to goodness, and finding goodness leads to beauty. What is good is beautiful, okay? And the beautiful is what stirs our heart into wonder. There is a cycle right there. This wonder, truth, goodness, beauty, back to wonder, okay? And ultimately, every human wants to know what is good. What is the good life? And that helps him to know how to pursue the good life. Is how we find a purpose to happiness. Okay, so that is your purpose. And ultimately, the most true good and beautiful is the beatific vision, is God Himself. It is three ladders converging onto one being. And that is what even our school, although it might not speak directly about Christian principles explicitly, it can still lead its students and teach them how to climb those ladders. And why Colwich Elementary can do something that some Catholic schools can't, which is create saints. If you know how to lead kids down that path to help them start to climb that ladder, just the tools of climbing that ladder, they can find the beatific vision. And I'm going to bet on God every time. So the final piece I'm going to end with is there's a gentleman named named Wendell Berry who wrote about Jaber Crow. And why I know I'm over time, but I seriously would be remiss if I didn't. This is something I'm very passionate about, and why I moved to Colwich. Jess and I pray to Saint Therese Novena, and it was confirmed. White roses on these tables. We know that God called us to be here, and we know we're called for this to be our community. And here's the thing. Here's why I'm passionate about Colwich Elementary more than anything. Because there's that quote, it takes a village to raise a child, but there's a backside to it, because the child belongs to the village. Who cares about the children of this village more than the villagers or themselves? We have 24 staff members who live in this town. We have people who are from the Quainies, the Heimermans, Kiers, Weddas, Winter, Ungles, Shear, Brand, Simon, Omo, and then our honorary town member Kincaid, who never lived here, but she spent more time in this town than a lot of people have. We have people who care a ton about this town. We have people who hold the values of this town. There is an essence to a Colwichian. I kind of feel like, you know, you take a tree, what do you call it, where you like tie it to another tree that's strong so that it can get rooted. That's what I feel like happened to me. Like, I'm like, oh, that's fertile soil, and I'm just a sapling, so I got tied to the shear tree, which is a part of the Brand and Simon tree, right? And I'm getting rooted, but luckily I'm part of something stable. I realize that this tree that I have been bound to bears good fruit. They care about this town. And there's something about the soil you're on, about being your brother's keeper. Wendell Berry talks about, he has this novel called Jaber Crow, and he does talk about how in this town, Port William, people are always coming and going, but the town was always there. And it will be there long after anyone else is there. And there is a responsibility to take care of the town so that when the next people come, it's better than when you came. Who cares about Colwich? Colwichians. We care about Colwich. He also speaks about a school. This is what he says. In his novel, a school closes down. The school in Port William. And here's a quote he says. Acting on the certified best advice of the official forces of education, they closed the Port Williams School. It was a good, sound building with swings, seesaws, and other playthings on the grounds around it. And they just locked the doors and sent the children in buses down to Hargrave. It was the school board's version of efficiency, economy of scale and volume, seeking capital. If you can milk 40 cows just as efficiently as 20, why can't you teach 40 children just as efficiently as 20, or for that matter, 100 or 200? Now, having no children of my own, I may have no right to an opinion. But I know that closing the school just knocked the breath out of the community. It did worse than that. It gave the community a never-healing wound. It was a great personal loss to me, for I loved seeing the children gathered and let loose, as if the schoolhouse breathed them in and out. I liked hearing the children's voices suddenly set free at the end of a school day. Some of the teachers, of course, had been bad, and some good. But how good or bad they were, Port William knew, and knew without delay. Now, whether the parents interfered for good or ill, the school was right there in sight, and they at least could interfere. The school was in the town, and it was in the town's talk. And when school closed, the town turned more of its attention away from itself. If people are driving down to Hargrave on school business for school events, they might as well shop in Hargrave or get their hair cut there. Port William lost business. I did. Now, I don't want to sound like a mercenary, but of course a community, to be a community, has to do a certain amount of its business within itself. Did anyone think it could be different? What does a school do for its community? One, it raises the next generation, prepares it to receive the inheritance, to be a good steward of the land. Second, it gives can give a united code. It can talk, give a same language of this is our expectations. And third, it gives you the right to call someone out. You know, every kid has the same capacity to feel anger and emotions and frustration as an adult does. Just the gravity of it is so much smaller. So when kids argue for the first time playing kickball and they want to get in a fist fight, that is really not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. But their emotional response is the same. So when those two kids are now 40 years old and they need to call each other out, one of them needs to call the other one out for being a dingbat. They earned that right through the kickball course, through being on the basketball team, through being on a football, through going through these things. And it doesn't matter if one of those guys becomes one of the most prominent people in the country or the other one has the most humble of jobs. He earned that right, and he gets to be his brother's keeper. Now, there are reasons to send your kids other places. I don't want to discredit that, and parents have to discern that. But I'm telling you this. My brother, one of his best friends, lives in Andale, and he hasn't seen him in a long time. But I know if Kay Dunbar goes to my brother and says, Martin, you need to be a husband, be a better husband and father right now, my brother would not buck him. Because Kay earned that right. He holds that right. That's the value of being in your school. You know each other on the streets. You walk on the streets. I see some of our kids, their neighborhood ends at the end of their driveway. But they know each other, for good or bad, or better or worse. Guess what? I can call out kids from Colwich because I can know them by name, and I can say, "Hey, Johnny, that's not what it means to be a Colwichian Cardinal. That's not hard. That's not being honest. That's not being loyal. That's not what we talk about." And I know them by name, and there's a power of the name. And not only that, but the parents know what we preach. So now the parents can call out other kids of other that are even from different parents. They can say, "Hey, that's not what we're about. We can be our brother's keeper. The village can actually raise the kid, and we can make a community of saints." And because evil persists, people will go off course. Adults will, kids will. But by golly, when they do, you'll have earned the right. And a school can do that. And that's a gift. That's a gift. And that's why it's not about me being anywhere else other than just I wanted to be the principal of Colwich Elementary. Because that's where my kids go. My kids are in this town. They grew up on this soil. And when my kids are being dingbats, their peers can call them out. And when their peers are being dingbats, my kids can call them out.
Oh.
And that's going to be good. And so I'm really passionate about that because if you feel that the state of this world is in a just culturally hard, I'm calling you. You don't have to go fight for the Wichita culture or anything, but fight for the Colwich culture. And And it's trench warfare, but reclaim what's yours. And make it better. And if our best families ship our kids away for different education, then our best are gone. Our most virtuous are gone. And they hurt the community that they're a part of. My wife says this. She says, don't be a cafeteria Colwichian. Be all in on what we're trying to do here so that we can all be in heaven one day. And that's an opinion of me and her. And we believe in it. And I do truly think there are reasons to maybe not send your kids here, even if you're not here. This is not about outliers. There are outliers, but this is about the majority. And I would claim that as a principal at Colwich Elementary, your kid being a saint matters to me because they will have an influence on my kid becoming a saint. And you have a principal who will not stop until he leads souls to heaven. He's just 100% invested in this town. And that's my vocation, and that's my time. 10 minutes, I took it.